Your name is Clarina?
Yes.
I know for a fact that the villain of the story, he only wore white. He dressed in white all the time. That is what I have been told. I have one picture of him where he is completely dressed in white.
Okay.
So your name is Sapphire?
Yes, my name is Sapphire.
We are in Hotel Memling because the villain of the film, in 1965, he was staying here. And he was dressing the way I am dressing now. So, first sentence is, this could either be...
Yes.
The world's biggest murder mystery.
Yes.
Or the world's most idiotic conspiracy theory. If the latter is the case...
Yes.
I am very sorry.
Years ago today, this organization, and much of the world as well, was shocked by a totally unexpected tragedy. Dirk Hammarskjöld, the Secretary General, was missing on a flight to Andorra, and all hope was lost when the remains of the Secretary General's plane were sighted from the air. He was, in a very real sense, the world's first public servant.
So this is Andorra.
This is Andorra Airport. It's your first time to come here?
Yes.
Your name?
Mats Brugger.
Mats Brugger.
Brugger.
Brugger. So I'm here.
And my name is Joran.
I'm Mas.
Mas.
Yes, me, Mas.
Mas.
Your name is also Mas?
Yes.
That would be
really
confusing.
Yes. Mas, M-A-S-S. That's my name.
It's exactly like my name. Nice to meet you, Mas.
Thank you.
But Mas, you know why we are here?
I don't know.
We are here because we are making a documentary about the death of Dag Hammarskjöld.
Okay. After a long time.
Yes.
It's a cold case, you know?
Yeah.
We want to find out if Hammarskjöld was the victim of a conspiracy.
Okay.
I mean, you've been doing your research for a long time?
Six years.
6 years? Or...
Yeah.
Okay. What is the title of your documentary?
The title?
Yes.
Cold Case Hammarskjöld.
Okay.
You think it's an okay title?
Do you have other title?
No.
Okay. Then does it means this one suits. So you have to leave it.
Now for the beginning of the film.
Yes.
The scene is, I am in a hotel in Lumumbashi.
Yes.
In Katanga.
Yeah.
The old Leopold II hotel. I am sitting in a room playing solitaire, you know, the card game.
Yeah.
And while you see me playing solitaire, there's a narration.
It's the 17th of September, 1961. Dag Hammarskjöld, the Secretary General of the United Nations, boards a plane in the capital of the Congo. These are the last recordings made of him because a few hours later, around midnight, he will be killed in a plane crash.
I know that I'm speaking for all of my fellow Americans, expressing our deep sense of shock and loss in the untimely death of the Secretary General of the United Nations, Mr. Dag Hammarskjöld.
The death of Secretary General Dag Hammarskjöld reverberated around the world. Officially, the plane crashed because of pilot error, a simple misreading of the altimeter. The UN later made their own investigation, which was undecided between pilot error and a possible attempt to bring the plane down. But right from the beginning, there were rumors about a conspiracy to kill Dag Hammarskjöld.
Första tanken, om jag vågar säga vad man tänker, att han har blivit mördad.
Much has been forgotten and much has been lost in the passage of time. But the questions remain. Was Dag Hammarskjöld murdered? And if so, who killed him?
Did you know about Hammarskjöld?
No, I didn't know.
Dag Hammarskjöld became the UN Secretary General in 1953. At first, he was believed to be a boring Swedish technocrat, but in fact, he was a flaming and strong-willed idealist.
It is very easy to bow to the wish of a big power. It is another matter to resist.
For Hammarskjöld, one of the most important tasks of the UN was to protect the African countries who had recently gained independence from the tactics of old colonial powers.
These new nations wish to build a life of progress in full independence. They look to the United Nations for moral, political and economic support.
This made him a lot of enemies amongst the British and the French, but he also became a thorn in the side of communist Russia, a new kind of imperialist.
With regard to the statement, Hammarskjöld's statement, that he would not leave his post, I said in my statement that Hammarskjöld would do so if he possessed the necessary chivalry, but he has not done this.
If there ever was a time when members of the UN were longing for the death of the Secretary General, it was during the reign of Dag Hammarskjöld.
Whatever happens, stick to your guns so that you can feel satisfaction with what you've done, whatever the outcome.
His plane crashed in the outskirts of a small mining town called Ndola, right on the border between the Congo and the British protectorate of Rhodesia. It was the perfect kill room, isolated and far away from prying eyes and ears. Hammarskjöld was on his way to Ndola for peace talks with Moise Tshombe, the rebel leader of the breakaway region, Katanga.
People need to know about Katanga. How Katanga in 1960 seceded from Congo, declared independence, and a war broke out. And it's important people understand that Katanga was basically the property of a giant Belgian corporation called Union Minière, a mining corporation, and it was more or less Union Minière who installed Moise Tshombe as the leader of Katanga.
Yes.
As a figurehead, because right below him, the big mining corporations were running the show. And they brought in a lot of mercenaries.
In a perspective which may well be short rather than long, the problem facing the Congo is one of peace or war.
Dag Hammarskjöld, he wants to fix the Katanga crisis.
Yes.
So he brings in UN soldiers, he attacks the mercenary army of Katanga,
yes,
thinking it would be a quick fix, but the mercenaries are hardcore. It's a disaster for the UN. Lots of civilians are killed, also UN soldiers.
Backed by mining interests and European mercenaries, Katanga had seceded from the Congo, and a UN-led military operation to capture Moise Tshombe and put an end to Katanga's secession from the Congo had backfired.
Mr. President, I regret that it has been necessary for me to call again the attention of the Security Council to the problem we are facing in the Congo.
So, the Americans, I think also the British, tell Dag Hammarskjöld, you have to fix this now. Mm. They're very angry at him.
Yes.
He has moved beyond his mandate. He has gone rogue. That is why he flies in, you know, to Katanga for meeting with Moise Tshombe, hoping that he can broker a peace deal with Moise Tshombe and stop the fighting.
Didn't, no.
Then he flies in And just as the plane is about to land, yeah, it crashes and he dies.
What's that? Let's go.
We are making a... We are doing a checkup on the equipment before we go to the burial site.
Okay.
Of the wreckage.
Yeah.
First of all, we need to have the pictures you have found.
This?
There? Yes. So they keep the wreckage of the Albertina Hammarskjöld's plane inside a sealed hangar for many months. And then in 62, they bury everything.
Yes.
And through this picture, we would be able to triangulate where the wreckage is buried.
Oh, yes, that should be very possible, you know, thanks to the buildings you can see up here. I think that's maybe the control tower, and there are some other buildings and a road here.
Let's go through the equipment I have prepared for us. There are two pith helmets, because we will be working in the sun to protect our Scandinavian skin. There are two shovels,
mm-hmm,
because if possible, and nobody takes offense, we should be digging for the wreckage. And we will find the wreckage ultimately by using this missile detector with an extra powerful coil that I purchased for us at Johannesburg. And finally, if and when we find the wreckage, two Cuban cigars.
Fast jag röker ju inte.
Björkdal.
Göran Björkdal. What happened was this. Göran's father was a diplomat working for the UN. In that capacity, he visited the crash site on Ndola, where Hammarskjöld was killed. It was sometime in the 70s.
He was given a metal plate, which allegedly was coming from damaged planes.
It was coming from Hammarskjöld's plane. The plate had these strange, small, round little holes in it, which made Göran's father wonder. So he brought the metal plate back to Sweden and asked the Ministry of Foreign Affairs if they had any interest in it. They told him no.
They told him no?
No.
And so, many years later, when Göran's father is going to a nursing home for elderly people, Göran finds the metal plate amongst his father's belongings. He asks his father what the metal plate is about. And from that point onwards, Göran has been obsessed with the murder mystery of Dag Hammarskjöld.
So, if you write, Clarina?
Yes.
All by himself, Jörn does something groundbreaking. He travels to Ndola and begins tracking down the remaining black witnesses.
Over there, then. Where was
inside.
It was that time, okay.
Black people were not taken seriously as witnesses.
After the crash happened, did you hear anyone from the government or from the police or anywhere asking people to come and tell what they saw, what they heard about the airplane?
No.
And furthermore, many of them were afraid to come forward.
You know, they were thinking, if they have killed Dag Hammarskjöld,
yeah,
what will they do to me if I tell them what I know? They were charcoal burners living in the forest very close to the crash.
Yeah.
So they were the witnesses who were as close to the event as possible.
We could see the plane going to the airport to land. But suddenly, I don't know what happened, the lights went off at the airport.
They talk about another plane in the air which is shooting at Dag Hammarskjöld's plane.
And the lights suddenly went
loud. Number.
You said you heard a sound.
Yes, another sound.
Another sound.
Yes, that sound was like a jet.
I don't know what you mean by jet. I don't know what you mean by jet. I don't know what you mean by jet.
Okay. Kali ka kanono na kali chikun.
Kanono san. Ya deke kalamba no be ali kali kali so munuma ni kambi. Yo echo kali ile pum. Elio muliro atambulo kwa kapamulo.
Tuwa mwenyo muliro waya kasamwea.
And the big plane got fire and going down.
Pia!
Tawale isayo. Mukumana kwesua mwene si.
Pia!
I told my boss, Mr. Jimmy James, he was my boss at that time. He was a Briton. And I said, something happened. What happened? There were no lights. The lights were switched off at the airport. And he just told me,
it came from the east because the pilot, you know, made a long turn to avoid Katanga airspace, and the plane continued towards the west, that side, and it disappeared in the horizon. And just when it disappeared in the horizon over there, there was a bright red flash.
Over there?
Over there, yes. People in Ndola saw it.
Yeah.
Many people saw it.
And what about Martin, who was here manning the tower?
Yeah, the radio controller, Martin, he claims he didn't see it, which is strange, because normally he should have been sitting inside the tower looking in that direction. He said he didn't see it. And that's not the only strange thing. Martin, of course, he took notes. A controller has to take notes of the conversation with the pilots. He took notes, but for some reason, he destroyed his notes the next day. So, 2 days after the crash, he had to rewrite his notes.
Jørgen begins looking for the killers.
So,
Jørgen begins looking for the killers.
Time?
He's on his side. Because archives are opening up.
In archive in Oxford, he found the first lead.
A cassette tape which contains information about a landmark meeting in Monaco in southern France in 1967. Here at this hotel, the French diplomat Claude de Camilleria is...
Claude de Camilleria
is paid a visit by three men who present themselves as missionaries on their way to Africa.
One of the men is a Belgian citizen named Roger Beukels.
Beukels.
Beukels, who claims to be a pilot, tells de Camilleria that he is the one who shot down Hammarskjöld's plane, working under orders from a mysterious Commander X.
Camilleria notices that Beukels is a mess of a man. He is severely alcoholized, skinny, and seems nervous. Then Beukels and his two friends leave the Camilleria never to be seen again.
Never to be seen again. Whoa. How they disappear like that?
That is something also very strange.
Okay.
Beukels only appears one time. Mm-hmm. He visits the Camilleria, and then he vanishes.
Here you can see the control tower. So this spot, it must be just down here. Just down there, actually.
Yeah.
My big ambition is to bring it up.
All of it has to come out.
Yes, because of new technology.
No, you only have two shovels. Oh, you have to find it first.
Yes. First I have to find it.
Okay.
But, we will come back in the morning with the metal detector.
Okay.
And then we will try to sweep to see if there's anything there.
Okay. Yeah. Probably about somewhere. Okay.
Yeah, it must be somewhere this direction.
Yeah, it's very close here.
Because, you know, because of new technology, if you can re-examine the wreckage, it is possible to say, was there explosives involved?
Yeah. So there wasn't any black box found on the aircraft?
No, there wasn't any black boxes at that time.
Ah, oh, okay. Before, well, yeah.
The black box.
Too old. Yeah.
After Oxford, Jørgen goes to London. In the Travelers Club, he meets with a former American NSA officer, a man named Charles Southall.
Now it has started.
Yes. Hello, I'm Charles Southall.
NSA is an American intelligence organization.
I was a naval officer.
They are basically spying on the whole world.
I was home with my young family and received a telephone call saying, you really should come out to the station around midnight because something interesting is going to happen. And shortly after midnight, a recording came through from somewhere down in Africa. I don't remember where it came from, and I probably didn't even know at the time. But one of the watch supervisors commented that this is history, and it's only 7 minutes old. And it was a recording of a man that we were aware of, a Belgian mercenary pilot, who we called the Lone Ranger. He apparently was up in a Fuga Magistère. He said, I see a transport coming in low. I'm going down to take a look at it. And he said, I'm going to make a run on it. And then you could hear, this is really chilling, you could hear the gun cannon firing, rat-tat-tat. And he said, I've hit it. There are flames coming out of it. And quite quickly he said, it's crashed. And that was the end of the recording. And we processed this recording and sent it off to Washington. And we all went home then. At the time we heard this recording, I did not know this was the aircraft that was transporting Dag Hammarskjöld and his staff and his personal security people.
There were never taken any so-called in situ pictures of Dag Hammarskjöld's body, pictures of the body as it looked like when it was found at the crash site. The first pictures were taken after he had been moved onto a stretcher. And here, in the shirt collar of Dag Hammarskjöld, a playing card can be seen. And by the way, this playing card is not mentioned in the autopsy report. But, you may ask, what kind of playing card was it? The first civilian photographer admitted to the crash site, a man named Norman Kenward, claims to know the answer.
Yes, I was the local photographer. And in the early afternoon, I say early afternoon, I received a telephone call asking me if I had heard anything about the Dag Hammarskjöld plane crashing.
Who was it calling you?
A police officer. Yes. He said to me, my advice to you is, have your cameras ready. And with that, I immediately jumped in the car with no other assistance with me, and I raced towards Indola.
How many days did it take to find his bodies?
It took 15 hours.
15 hours?
Yes. But it crashed 8 miles from the airport. The airport. Okay. And there was a big fire, you know.
I went there with my friend. But still, there was a very big fire in the morning.
Yeah.
So it must have been easy to see.
As I arrived at the crash site, I parked my car and got the equipment I needed, my camera, Rolleiflex camera. As I walked along the track, to the left of me was a pile of bodies. Right? I casually said to one of the persons there, I said, oh, you know, what's going on? Oh, he said, we're putting Hammarskjöld into the ambulance.
You know, it's complicated because when they found his body at the crash site...
It's really a mystery story.
No, but when they found his body at the crash site...
Yeah.
All the other passengers, most of them,
They were totally burned.
Okay.
And in bits and pieces all over the place.
Yeah.
But Hammarskjöld, he was just lying on the ground,
floor, yeah.
You know, like this.
Yes.
Remarkably undamaged.
Mm. Okay, he was lying like that.
Yes.
And then comes the most important detail.
So a few days later, you meet the exact same police officer in the
Correct.
Streets. And you have a conversation which you choose to keep secret for a great many years.
Yes. And he said, oh, by the way, he said, did you hear about Hammarskjöld? I said, well, you know, I believe he was dead or died or whatever. He said, oh, he said, did you see him up close? I said, no, I did not. He said, well, between you and me, rumour, and I say rumour has it, he had the death card in his collar. So I said, the death card? I said, the ace of spades. He said, yes. I said, my goodness, you know, what a coincidence sort of thing, you know. By the way, he said, please, Norman, don't mention that to anyone. He said, after all, it's not released officially to anyone.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, according that would actually fit with the map. If the burial spot is
there,
it should make a sound there and not over here. Yeah. So it, yeah, that makes sense.
So just to be 100% sure, should we check out the other place?
Facts we learned about the supposed mercenary pilot Boikels, taken from the cassette tape which Jørn Bjørkdal found in Oxford. Full name is Roger Boikels, nationality Belgian. He was an alcoholic in bad health and worked for a construction company in Brussels. From these leads, our Belgian researcher tracked down the only man matching this profile, a Belgian national named Roger Boikels, who served as a mercenary in the Congo in the 60s. Roger Boikels is dead now, but his nephew Jan Boikels, a former Belgian policeman, remembers his uncle clearly.
He was always gently, friendly, soft. Yes.
But he always had a gun with him.
Is that correct? He always had a gun with him?
And a Milster 37 and a 36 in his car.
That is a hand grenade?
Yes, you mean hand grenade M36.
In his car?
In his car, yes.
Why?
I don't know. He was scared of something.
No? Scared of whom?
Another person who knew Roger Boikels well is a Belgian woman named Lydia.
Il était très très renfermé, très taiseux. Il avait horreur des photos. Il allait à des rencontres, mais il n'a jamais dit où il allait et avec qui.
She even has pictures of Boikels when he was in the Congo.
Okay.
And she tells us that, yes, Boikels, he used to work for a construction company in Brussels. He was severely alcoholized. At one point, he lost a lot of weight.
Mm-hmm.
He was a psychopath, mentally deranged.
Mm-hmm.
Was he paranoid? Was he afraid somebody was after him?
Oui. Oui, parano, oui. Parano, oui.
He went to the Congo?
Yes, Chombe army.
Yes, in the 60s?
Yes.
There's only one thing missing.
He wasn't a pilot, you know. He was a mercenary. But a pilot? No.
You're sure he was not a pilot?
No.
Savait pas piloter. Ah non, ça je suis formel. Formel.
He was not a pilot?
No.
Yeah, you're no. 100% sure?
Ça je suis certain.
Yes.
No.
Why would he go to the south of France in 67 to meet with a French diplomat claiming that he did it? Why would he do that? Do you have any idea?
Probably he was forced to do that.
Forced by whom?
Security systems, you know. Yes.
Can you read that sentence to me?
Yeah. In September 2013, the story moved beyond the realm of conspiracy theory for the senior citizens.
Yes, because it's only old people who remember Star Kammerschult.
Okay.
So it's something which only interests old people.
Yeah.
Maybe this film will change it. I don't know.
Why not?
Why not? Let's hope.
Okay.
No, what happened is they have a press conference in the Peace Palace where a commission of jurists who have been investigating the case presents their conclusions.
Mm-hmm.
The commission will present the report on its inquiry into the cause of death of the former Secretary General of the United Nations, Dag Hammarskjöld, in 1961.
The purpose of the report is to evaluate the new body of evidence uncovered about the death of Dag Hammarskjöld, not least thanks to the work of Jørn Bjørkdal.
I may say, Mr. Bjørkdal, that we've been very much assisted by the research that you've made available to us.
Thanks.
There are many interesting findings in the report. The Commission of Jurists had also been searching for the Belgian mercenary pilot Rogier Buykels, but had drawn a blank.
The Buykels history, it may be true, it may not be true. The most important thing here we found are the witness statements that gives cause for really focusing on air traffic, radio traffic in Atendola that particular night. Thank you.
On that matter, the commission had asked the U.S. National Security Agency, the NSA, if they had any records in their archives matching the description of intercepted radio traffic given by former NSA officer Charles Southall.
The archive's response, as we record in section 15.12, has been that of three documents or records which appear to respond to our request, two are classified top secret on national security grounds.
This means, yes, we have the records you're looking for, but you cannot have them. But even more interesting is the question of whether a bomb had been planted in Dag Hammarskjöld's plane. When the UN did their first investigation of the crash back in 1962, it was discovered that Dag Hammarskjöld's plane, the Albertina, had been left completely unguarded at the airport for at least 2 hours before takeoff, which would make it possible for a determined person to plant a bomb inside the plane. But, as the investigators wrote at the time, this is no more than a theory, not even supported by circumstantial evidence.
What nevertheless lends apparent substance to the bomb theory is the batch of documents purportedly originating from a body called the South African Institute for Marine Research. Maritime Research? Maritime Research.
So now we are going to South Africa.
Are you going to talk about the Madiba story?
About what?
What happened there?
About apartheid?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Because, you know, in 1998...
Yeah.
The Truth and Reconciliation Commission?
Mm-hmm.
They are closing down.
In August 1998, having spent more than 4 years investigating the crimes of the apartheid regime, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was closing down. To mark the end of their work, they held a final press conference in Cape Town, chaired by Archbishop Desmond Tutu.
It is a very special moment for all of us. We have discovered in the course of our investigations documents purporting to be from an institution called the South African Institute of Maritime Research, discussing the sabotage of the aircraft in which the United Nations Secretary General Doug Hammarskjöld died on the night of September 17, 1961.
Has everybody got a copy of this set of documents?
Yes. Institute for Maritime Research.
No. How many are missing? Sorry, just indicate.
The documents comes from, allegedly from a shadowy private paramilitary intelligence organization known as the South African Maritime Research Institute. And they are the manuscript for killing Dag Hammarskjöld. The full set of documents discovered in the vaults of South Africa's Secret Service was said to consist of 12 pages, but the originals have since vanished in South African state archives. What remains are blurred photocopies of 9 pages, outlining a plot to kill Dag Hammarskjöld with a bomb. The documents say that Hammarskjöld had to be removed because the United Nations had become troublesome. Among the conspirators, British intelligence is mentioned, as well as the American Intelligence Service, the CIA.
Do you know whether the institute still exists?
Yes, in fact, when we got this statement, which was about a few months ago, the first thing that we did was to send an investigator to establish whether, in fact, there is an institute of this nature. We are of the view that there is an institute, though in a different form or a slightly different form.
But none of the journalists went to look for the institute themselves. Maybe because the British Foreign Office, as well as the CIA, quickly scrambled to bury the story as a piece of Cold War misinformation planted by the Russians. As a result, the South African Institute for Maritime Research, or in short, SIMAR, remains mostly uncharted territory.
It is not impossible that the account carried by these documents is genuine, but it is just as possible that they are a well-informed fabrication.
What little we know about SIMAR today is thanks to the South African journalist David Potgieter. Back in the early 90s, he met with a man who claimed to be the Commodore of SIMAR, a man named Keith Maxwell.
He described himself as commander of the SIMAR's military unit, Delta. And he said that the unit is the successor of an 184-year-old organization first formed by a group of British mariners. Preferring to remain anonymous, the group's interests are diverse. Some orders come from London and others are initiated here in South Africa.
David Potgieter takes the only photo known to me of Maxwell. This is him. The leader of SIMAR, the Commodore. You see how he's dressed in white?
White, yes.
I think because SIMAR was a maritime organization, so they claim to be. So the standard uniform for SIMAR personnel was whites, navy whites. But Maxwell was also posing as a doctor.
He's a very flamboyant person, wearing a safari suit, white safari suit and white shoes. And in some quarters, he referred to himself as Dr. Maxwell Annandale, but he was not a medical doctor or any doctor of any sort. And from what I've gathered, what I've seen in the surgery, there were black women lying on beds with with funny machines making beep sounds, and he was sort of experimenting on black people. And he was very much involved in AIDS research and the spread of AIDS in Africa as well. But he was very, very forthcoming when I confronted him with facts and stuff, and he gave me information regarding it.
Maxwell is dead now.
Yeah.
But while being there, I managed to find the widow of Maxwell.
Yes.
Her name is Diane.
Mm-hmm.
And I speak with her on the phone while I'm driving around during nighttime.
Yes.
On the highways of Johannesburg.
My marriage was very difficult, and that's the way it is. It became very difficult for me, and I don't enjoy the past being brought up, actually.
Can I ask, were you afraid of Keith? Was he abusive?
Not physically, but verbally, mentally, maybe.
Yes. Did he ever mention the former United Nations Secretary General Dag Hammarskjöld?
I think he might have mentioned it once or twice, maybe, but he didn't say much. He just said that this chap had died, and that was about it.
Do you know anything about SIMA, the South African Maritime Research Institute? Did he share any information with you about that?
That was a little organization that my husband set up for some reason or other, yes.
He was the founder of that organization?
I think so.
But what did he tell you that the organization was about?
What it was about?
Yeah?
Just set it up. I don't know why he set it up. If you want my frank opinion, I think my husband was probably a little bit mentally ill. And at the end, I thought he was a bit mentally ill, and I thought he was just playing games. And you used to play games, but yeah, just playing with other people's minds to see what they would do.
And she tells me some very disturbing things about Maxwell.
Okay.
How he liked to manipulate other people.
People.
Play with their minds.
Mm.
How abusive and evil he was.
Yeah. How and evil was.
Well, you know what he did?
No.
He was running a number of clinics in the black townships?
Yes.
Pretending to be a medical doctor.
Yeah.
The surgery where Devet Potgieter met Keith Maxwell in the early 90s is now gone.
Yeah, but Keith Maxwell Annandale.
Keith Annandale of Keith Maxwell Annandale as a double barrel surname.
Yeah, but they say either I come as Keith Maxwell.
Keith Maxwell Annandale.
But Potgieter discovers that Maxwell had more than one surgery.
The old lady is inside here.
Keith Maxwell Annandale.
Oh yeah. Was he a doctor or something?
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, he had a place down the road there, but it used to be the old post office.
Oh, he had the surgery here.
That's correct.
Oh, that's interesting.
Oh yeah, he was always wearing white safari suits.
Yeah, that's correct.
We discovered that he was running a number of clinics in the townships around Johannesburg.
Mm-hmm.
Offering medical assistance to black people at a very low cost.
Yeah. Oh yeah, we haven't even the name.
Is it?
Yeah, exactly.
Come stay here, then you can have it nice. Come stay here. Dr. Maxwell, is it?
And at that point in time, Jørgen and I, we had difficulties finding out what these clinics were about. Why was he running these clinics? And people we talked to tells us about how he was experimenting on black people.
I can just find his car in the whole Patwantin. That's his car there.
Oh, that's his car.
The clients who came here, did they seem to be satisfied with the treatment that they got?
No.
They were not?
It was more of a chance, you know. Because I used to sit with him and see what they do, you know.
Quick.
They did run quick, yes, more quick, you know. Mm. Make his money out of this. And he would drown there and put them in the drum and roll them and, you know, give them a just false injections, you know.
Oh, you have injections to the
hospital? Yeah,
oh.
Don't be scared, man. You can tell them.
No, there's no... There's nothing funny about it.
I just want to find out people that remember you knew him and that kind of thing. You can tell us.
No, that man, white man, was it? He was a searcher. He was not staying here. He come every day, close it, and time for day.
When you come here, also getting the plenty people sitting outside waiting for a doctor. I know his name because at home I think I'm what?
Dr. Maxwell.
Yeah.
Dr. Maxwell.
Yeah. Was the old man guy put it on the machine, press your hands.
And he had a kind of a drum, you know, like a drum.
Yeah.
Used to put the patients through there.
Oh,
then he used to tell them that he could see what's inside the body and all that stuff, you know.
There's some mystery about him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Nice little thing, you know.
But apparently he's very quiet and...
Oh, very, very quiet. But a sharpshooter.
They came to rob him.
Mm-hmm.
And he shot one or two guys dead.
Mm-hmm.
He was very good with a firearm. I think even before he shot someone.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he's an expert in guns. Of course, he was a mercenary, you know.
Mm. He was a mercenary.
Yeah, so he knows.
He said that.
Right? Yeah.
He said that.
Yeah, he used to... They seem to have been hired out to go to Congo and all those in African countries.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Did he ever talk about a man named Dag Hammarskjöld? Dag Hammarskjöld.
Doesn't come into my mind.
Potgieter and Maxwell met several times. They never discussed the killing of Dag Hammarskjöld, and Maxwell never shared the documents, which later ended up in the hands of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, with Potgieter. But Maxwell gave Potgieter hundreds of other documents from the files of Saimaa, documents outlining plans for state coups in other African countries, with code names such as Operation Albatross, Operation Crusader, and Operation Anvil. More importantly, Maxwell also gave Potgieter the first part of the manuscript of a fictionalized account of Maxwell's life entitled The Story of My Life.
Oh, there you are.
It's the story of Maxwell's life, but fictionalized with other names. It's also in that manuscript that we learn that in 1965, Maxwell was staying here at the Hotel Memling,
mm-hmm.
where we are now.
It tells how, as a young man, Maxwell is recruited into Saimaa in the memoir simply called The Marine Institute. At a farm outside of Johannesburg, Maxwell is being trained with other Saimaa cadets, all dressed in whites. They are given lessons in psychological warfare and the dark arts in general. Maxwell's handler in Saimaa is a strict and stern officer named Robert Wagman. At the end of Maxwell's training, Commander Wagman sends him to the Congo on a clandestine mission for the Marine Institute. In the Congo, Maxwell ends up at a secret jungle laboratory funded and operated by the U.S. Army. Here, research is being done into biological warfare and how to weaponize viruses. Finally, Keith Maxwell, who calls himself Ken Marshall in his memoir, has a fallout with the commander of the jungle laboratory, who expels Maxwell from the premises. Maxwell then travels to the capital of the Congo, stays at Hotel Memling for a while, and then goes back to South Africa. Here, the memoir breaks off, unfinished. Not a word is written about Dag Hammarskjöld and how he died in September 1961.
What do you think?
I'm a bit confused because it's a lot of names and a lot of people that are mentioned, yeah.
Yes, many names. But that is... It is a very complicated story.
Mm.
Maybe too complicated.
The reason for making it complicated is, of course, the 9 secret documents released by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission back in 1998, outlining a conspiracy to kill Dag Hammarskjöld.
The code name for the operation to kill Dag Hammarskjöld was Operation Celeste.
Today, 20 years later, the Operation Celeste papers from Saimaa remain a complete mystery. No one knows who wrote them, nor why or when. If the documents are to be trusted as genuine, it is first and foremost necessary to prove that Saimaa did exist as a real organization. The best way to do this would be to find other members of Saimaa besides Keith Maxwell, because in theory, all of this could be an elaborate hoax embedded in reality by Keith Maxwell. The Operation Celeste papers mention a secret agent codenamed Congo Red, who works for Saimaa in the Congo. They also tell how the explosives for the bomb to kill Dag Hammarskjöld were provided by the Belgian mining corporation Union Minière. The bomb fails to explode at takeoff, but the agent Congo Red writes that a contingency plan was activated. An eagle is being dispatched, most likely a reference to a jet fighter, and just as Dag Hammarskjöld's plane is about to land at Ndola Airport, the plane crashes and he dies.
And in the end, Congo Red confirms the job has been done.
Besides Congo Red, we have an agent for the CIA codenamed Dwight. He is to meet his liaison from Saimaa at the old Leopold II Hotel in the capital of Katanga, today the Park Hotel. There's no trace left of Dwight having stayed at the hotel in 1961. The only real names given in the Operation Celeste papers are names of senior Saimaa officers. We have a Commodore R. Wagner, probably the same person as Commander Robert Wagman, the officer who was in charge of the Marine Institute in Maxwell's memoir. This man seems to be impossible to track down, and so are Dr. Pike and Captain Iron Kerr.
Oh,
so, the only confirmed member of Saimaa so far is Keith Maxwell. But there could be other members of Saimaa. I did manage to find this article, which was published in the Sunday Times magazine in South Africa in 1989. Here, a young woman named Debbie Campbell talks about how she works for Saimaa and Dr. Keith Maxwell. It's a weird piece of journalism. Debbie is pictured in a white navy uniform, and she says she has been given the rank of ensign in Saimaa, a 200-year-old private organization which fights pollution and AIDS, according to Dr. Maxwell. Debbie talks about how she was recruited into Saimaa out of school when she was only 13, and how she now does research at Maxwell's AIDS clinic. She also works at another clinic where special Saimaa research is conducted. But Debbie Campbell seems to have vanished from the face of the earth. My quest to track her down has been in vain, and the journalist who wrote the article claims she has forgotten all about it. Luckily, there are other names to work on. In the trove of Saimaa documents, which Keith Maxwell handed over to journalist David Potgieter, several people are mentioned, including a South African doctor named Claude Newbery.
Good afternoon. Hello, Mr. Newbery.
Yes, hello.
I'm Mads Brugger. I'm a journalist from Denmark.
How do you do? How do you do?
Fine, thank you. And this is Jørgen Bjørkdal, whom you spoke with on the phone.
Yes,
we spoke on the phone.
Yeah. I'm interested how you guys get my mobile number.
Dr. Newbery, who is known in South Africa as a pro-life anti-abortion campaigner, confirms having befriended Keith Maxwell.
He was a very pleasant person and very humorous. He was the sort of person who made lots and lots of jokes, you know. He could make a joke easily. One evening, we were invited to dinner, and he said, well, would you like to become a member of Saimaa? So I said, well, what does it entail? And it seemed to entail only the investigation, the research into sunken treasure.
And please go on. Well, what happens that evening?
There was a little bit of a ceremony. He had been dressed up like an admiral in the British Navy from about 250 years ago, you know, with a tricorn hat and a cutlass and a naval uniform with lots of buttons, and that was it.
Who was wearing that?
That was Mr. Maxwell.
He was dressed like that?
Yes, yes. In fact, my impression of it was that the South African Maritime Research Institute was just a sort of a hobby that somebody had decided to play an adventurous game and looking for treasure and hoping to become very rich thereby.
How often did you meet with Maxwell?
He was the only contact we had was discussions about the pro-life movement. And then at a later stage, he asked me about what I thought about the AIDS virus.
And what did he tell you?
Well, he indicated that he thought it was a product of biological warfare.
In fact, Keith Maxwell was obsessed with AIDS, writing extensively about how Saima was doing research into the HIV virus and the possibility of using the virus as a weapon to kill black people.
Sorry, Max, would you tell me, was he affected with AIDS?
Who?
Maxwell? Yeah.
No.
No.
No, but he was interested in using AIDS to kill black people.
In his master plan, Keith Maxwell writes about how AIDS will play an important role in South Africa's political future. As refugees from the disease pour into South Africa from the north, they will bring the virus with them, and the black population with whom they mingle will become infected on a large scale. As a result, Maxwell concludes, South Africa will have a white majority in the year 2000.
But, says Maxwell, the deaths of millions of people would actually be a good thing for humanity as a whole, referring then to the overpopulation.
Yes. Well, that's not the person that I know.
Mm.
Maxwell was, if you would put it simply, he was on the side of the good guys, inasmuch as he was against population control, he was against genocide, and he was trying to discover a cure for the HIV virus. He wanted me at one time to join or to start a clinic in a building out in Benoni where he had visualized a medical clinic. Now, he wasn't a medical doctor, and I am a medical doctor. And when I said to him, no, I wasn't prepared to do that, he seemed to be very upset with me, and that was the end of our relationship.
Another person mentioned in the Saima documents is a man named René Gord. According to the documents, he was second in command in the South African Institute for Maritime Research, working directly under Commodore Keith Maxwell in the early 90s.
You say Gord?
René Gord.
René Gord, okay. In all of South Africa, there's only one man named René Gord. He has a security company in Johannesburg. Joran and I went to visit him.
Yes. And you know what happens? He comes out of the building. We ask him if he is René Gord, who was in charge of Saima, second in command after Maxwell.
Mm-hmm.
He says absolutely not. He has never been involved with Saima. Then we show him some Saima documents with the signature of René Gord.
Is this, I mean, here we have a document.
Yeah.
Signed by René Gord, is not...
That is my signature.
It is yours?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So how can we explain that?
I don't know.
How is that possible?
We'll work it out.
And we ask, how come? And then he says he is the victim of identity theft. But have they used that identity theft, you know, for taking out bank loans, buying cars?
Nothing.
Only for this?
Yeah, it appears to be.
But that is bizarre.
Yeah, it is bizarre.
Do you know a man named René Gord?
Yes, I used to know him. I haven't seen him for many, many years.
Was she a friend of Keith?
I think they were in acting classes together. They went and they did drama.
They did drama?
Acting classes. Yeah, you know, put on plays and stuff.
You know, we just try to find out what kind of organization Simon was and what they were doing. We don't try to incriminate anybody or so.
I don't know.
To get the information.
We also spoke to a source who said that you did drama classes together with Keith Maxwell.
No, I did do drama classes, yes.
Really?
Yes.
What year?
I can't remember.
Before the 90s?
Wasn't that maybe. With Keith? Maybe. Keith Maxwell?
I can't remember.
You weren't a close friend to Keith Maxwell?
No.
What kind of drama was it? What kind of?
Nothing serious.
Was it like Shakespeare or?
No, not at all.
Was it impro?
Improvisation.
Yeah.
That handwriting under the signature. Is that yours? This handwriting here.
That is my handwriting.
It is your handwriting?
Yeah, it is my handwriting.
So it's also you writing, Lieutenant Commander?
No, not me, but it is my handwriting. It is my handwriting, but I don't know this document.
Why on earth would Keith Maxwell and his cohorts go to these lengths with stealing your identity?
I don't know, because I don't know the background of this organization. I don't know what they were up to. Really, I have no idea.
The SIMA papers also mention a South African general named Tini Groenewald.
Tini Groenewald, former general and chief director of military intelligence, former attaché at the South African embassy in London.
And coming back, particular time he came back and he sort of became chief of military intelligence. So since then he's been involved in intelligence work, military intelligence, all his life.
Jørn and I, we go to visit Groenewald. And Groenewald tells us that he met two times with Maxwell.
He was neatly dressed, he was well spoken. He appeared to be someone who was in authority.
He even has Maxwell's name written in his calendar. Maxwell comes to meet Groenewald and tells him if he is interested in...
Before apartheid?
Just before apartheid ends.
Yes.
In the last days of apartheid.
Yes.
Maxwell comes to meet Groenewald and tells him if he wants weapon and money for arming white people to go up against black people.
Black people.
Like a civil war.
Okay.
Maxwell can help him.
He had the resources to use violence and to supply weapons and so on and so forth. Now, we did not need Maxwell. And we soon realized that he represented some foreign intelligence agency. I was convinced. I couldn't prove it. But I was convinced that he was financed and directed by MI6 of British intelligence. How? After spending 3.5 years in Britain, you get to know some people involved in the intelligence field. And certain of the names which I mentioned in our discussions was familiar to him. Which told me, well, obviously he knows these people.
So Groenewald was convinced that Maxwell was working for MI6, British intelligence. And because of that, he told him no. And they never meet again. That is very interesting. What is also interesting is that I asked Groenewald if he has ever heard about SIMA, South African Maritime Research Institute, and Groenewald says never. He has never heard about that organization.
No, I can't see this organization as really playing a significant part. If they did, I would have known about it.
Do you have the Operation Sinister papers, right, Jørn?
Some of them, yes. They're here.
Could you show them to the general?
just to get his, you know.
Yes, of course. I mean, I don't know if you've seen these particular papers, but this is, I think, four documents. Here's one, giving some orders.
You see, now my question always is this authentic, or is this, did they try and create an impression that the CIA, for example, was involved?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's very easy to do this.
Yeah.
Let me say that you would be very, very careful if the CIA was involved of putting something like this on paper. You'd be very, extremely careful because, I mean, I was involved in the intelligence world, and you won't tolerate something like this.
Yeah.
You know, and who do they write to?
These are like orders given to...
That's orders given.
You see now, specifically in orders given to an operational chap, you don't want them to know this. If you are in command, they accept that you know where the orders are coming from, you know who's involved, you know where the money is coming from. You're not going to tell an operator that. If you do, then it's highly, it's not professional. Not professional at all.
I don't even know what to think. But if it was something real, wouldn't this person who was the commander of the military, like, know anything about it?
Exactly. How come Grünewald had never heard about Saimar?
Sorry, did you finish the story? Rita?
About Saimar?
Yeah. About Maxwell?
Yes, for now, because we come back to... We come back to South Africa
okay.
later.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, omelette.
Okay. So this camera guy was standing somewhere there, and they took it that way.
You still have the road here?
No, but well, listen, it is here. I'm getting a massive reading.
Yeah.
It is here.
Yeah, it's here. We found it.
It is freaking out.
Yeah, we found it. It's here. Yeah. Yeah, so we found the spot.
The question is, how deep down is it?
That's the question.
You can see on the photos, it's 3-4 meters.
Deep.
According to this.
Yeah.
Can we do some digging here?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yes.
Then, soon after, Jørgen, the UN appoints an expert panel of 3 persons.
Acting on the report from the Commission of Jurists, the UN appoints a 3-person expert panel tasked with evaluating the new body of evidence in the Dag Hammarskjöld crash.
And they learn about Jørgen's metal plate. Remember the one with the little holes?
Det här, det här är en del av
planet.
Förmodligen en del av planet. Ja.
Ja, så det fanns en historia om det.
Ja, just det. Då. Nej, men det är så att man FN har tillsatt en panel av experter som ska titta på om huruvida han blivit mördad. Jag ska lämna den här till dem ikväll. Så att de ska försöka undersöka om det verkligen är en del av det planet. Det är nästan säkert. Alltså det är svårt att stämma.
And they come to Stockholm to meet with Jørgen, and he hands over the metal plate. We are hoping, of course, that this metal plate is the smoking gun
It's a bit like in films when people have to dig their own grave. I just need a time out, Jørgen. I'm about to be throwing up.
Oh, Jesus. Can I give a hand?
Jørgen, did you have the gel?
Yes.
Because I'm having blisters?
Yeah. I mean, if they're broken, you know, it may be good to clean them. It hurts a lot. It hurts a lot.
Thank you. Safar, you remember I told you Jørgen met with the three-man expert panel in Sweden?
Yeah.
They took the metal plate to FBI laboratories in the USA.
Yeah.
And they tested the plate. And the conclusion was the plate has zero probative value.
Yeah.
It has never been inside a plane. It probably comes from a Land Rover. And the holes in it does not come from ammunition.
Okay.
You understand?
Yeah.
It's bad news for Jørgen. Amazingly, we are given permission to start digging inside the airport. But then suddenly someone calls from Lusaka and tells the airport to stop this. They don't want us to be digging for the wreckage.
Okay.
So, you know, also close, but no cigar.
Permission has to come from somewhere else.
I, you know, my principle is that it's better to ask for forgiveness than permission.
No. Okay. No, in the airport, no. In the airport, it's better to ask for permission than forgiveness.
Isn't that a bit too early?
It's never too early for cigars, Jørgen.
You're shaking.
Yeah. All the activities with looking for the wreckage has really gone to my nerves.
I thought you were a cool man, but
no, but you know. You know, the feeling you have when you're really close to something, but then you're further away than ever before.
Is that the reason this story is still a mystery?
What?
That's the reason it became also fiction or fit?
No, it's not. This is not fiction.
Okay.
This is a documentary.
A documentary. All right.
But
to be honest, I was never really interested in the legacy of Dag Hammarskjöld because at the end of the day, most people have never heard about Dag Hammarskjöld, and when you get to see him, he comes across as a goofy character from a screwball comedy.
The explanation is a very simple one.
For me, Dag Hammarskjöld was most of all a ticket to all the things I really enjoy. Tracking down Belgian mercenaries, telling tales of evil men who dress in white, the ace of spades found at crime scenes, rumors about secret African societies. That is why I went along for the ride, not really knowing where it would lead. For 6 years, Jørgen and I worked the murder case. We traveled all over Africa and Europe, roaming around in archives and conducting enormous amounts of interviews with elderly white liver-spotted men.
The Long Ranger was, it was his name in England in the World War II.
Interesting.
So he was known as the Lone Ranger?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
We did have a few wins along the way. We managed to find the real name of the Belgian mercenary who probably brought down Hammarskjöld's plane.
This is, in fact, a picture, if you focus on Jan van Rissingham here and here, of the person who basically killed Dag Hammarskjöld.
Yes. Yes.
Did he tell you who gave him the order to bring down the plane?
No.
But this pilot is dead now. And when we came to see his widow, it did not play out as well as I had hoped.
Hello, Miss van Rissingham. My name is Mads Brügger. I'm a journalist from Denmark.
I don't know what that is all about.
Well, it's about... this is Jørgen Bjørkdal. He's from Sweden.
No, not this Hammarskjöld thing again.
It's Hammarskjöld.
In the archives of a former British spy, we discovered a never-before-seen telex from the rebel leader of Katanga, Moise Tshombe, to the Prime Minister of the British Protectorate, Rhodesia. Here, Tshombe asks for having two fighter jets delivered immediately. The telex is dated the day before Hammarskjöld was to come to Ndola for peace talks with Tshombe. But no one knows if the fighter jets were ever delivered. And not to forget, we found this never-before-published picture of Hammarskjöld's plane after the crash. It shows a big hole in the tail fin, but when all is said and done, it's just a hole, and who knows? So I began looking for a way out, because one thing I do care about is my own legacy.
It's because when they found Hammarskjöld's body, he had a playing card in his shirt collar. And I met a man who told me that he was at the crash site, that the playing card sitting in his shirt collar was the Ace of Spades. It's a weird detail.
If Jørgen Bjørkdal and I did not manage to crack open the case, I would employ all the old tricks of my trade. Costume play and role play, pith helmets and dressing up like Dr. Maxwell. This is also why I had the idea about employing not only one, but two African secretaries, hoping they would somehow save my shipwrecked film with their mere presence. If you ask me why two secretaries, not one,
Ulevi? Yeah.
I cannot explain it.
So, Karina, where were we?
It was an experiment. In short, I was hoping this charade would cover up my failures as a journalist. But instead, something much worse happened. All my fantasies came true. To be more precise, unknowingly, Jørgen Bjørkdal and I were on the verge of discovering a kind of horror which would put all my shenanigans to shame.
Yeah, there are still some question marks here.
There's a lot of question marks, Jørgen.
Yeah.
I think one of us have to go back to South Africa to study Saima more, to really get, you know, get to the heart of the matter. You have a list in front of you.
Yes.
What kind of list is that?
That is a list of people who responded to an advert that Keith Maxwell put out in 1989 when he was looking for mercenaries who then could be willing to sign up for a military operation in Africa.
For Saima?
For Saima, yes.
We have this long list of names. And we're basically going through all the names, trying to find their phone numbers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah?
I am calling because of a list of men who responded to adverts from a group known as Saimar.
Yes.
I believe you are one of them.
Yes.
What can you tell me about this group?
Well, we cannot talk about it yet. It's a bit dangerous, so we are not too keen on talking about things.
My own involvement in the forces that be at the time and the implications thereof and what we had to do and get up to, well, you know, I don't know if I'm willing to divulge anything on that.
Okay, but can you at least confirm that Saimar was real, that it did exist at one point in time?
I can't. I'm not at the liberty of speaking about it, sir.
What I did, I did. What I did, as far as I'm concerned, I was doing the correct thing. And, yeah, we'll leave it at that. All right, you must find other people that are maybe willing to discuss it, because I'm definitely not.
Where did you get my number from? It's not open to the public.
Well, that was a long time ago, so yeah, I'm not involved there anymore.
Forget about me.
Yeah, since most of these people have shown to be unwilling to speak on the phone, we will just, go to their houses and try to approach them, you know. Some may just tell us to fuck off, and others may be willing to talk.
Yuen and I, we find the street address of corresponding to one of the names, a man named Clive.
You're speaking about the maritime research, you're speaking about that?
Yes.
Oh, no, I'd done training with him for about 3 months.
3 months?
And then afterwards, everything just went basically quiet.
Okay.
I can try and look. I know I've got a certificate that I was issued with from the maritime.
You do?
You have that?
Wow. I have got a certificate. So
could you find that for us? That would be a great help.
Yes, I can find it for you. Here we go. This was 1993.
Incredible.
Look, 1993.
It is the real deal. He went to a secret Saimar training camp outside Johannesburg, where they were wearing white clothes. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I know, Clive, it's a long time ago, but can you recollect names of anybody in charge of Saimar when you were there?
There was one guy from the NCIS, whatever, the intelligence bureau, I remember, and it was an American guy.
An American guy?
Curly hair, black hair with a moustache.
The American guy is Robert Cedars. His resume reads like a real-life Rambo. Ex-Green Beret, ex-mercenary, he has worked for the Anglo-American Mining Corporation and the King of Afghanistan, and among his listed interests are parapsychology and rock and roll. He vaguely remembers working for Saimar as an instructor at the farm outside of Johannesburg in the early 90s.
I don't know about them. They supposed to hire me as a security guard to train people, but shit, they never did nothing. I don't think they went anywhere or did anything, so I don't know what the hell they did.
I'm basically interested in anything relating to the South African Maritime Research Institute. So, can we meet person
to
person?
No, man, I ain't got time to be taking guard. I don't know what the hell you talk about. What are you carrying on? I couldn't be bothered with this.
Do you remember a man named Keith Maxwell?
I met him a few times. He was supposed to organize us as security guards, but I don't know. Anyway, good luck on whatever you're looking for. Find out who killed President Kennedy. Do something important.
Okay, so in 93, we have you on a farm here in Johannesburg.
Yes.
Training together with Bob Cedars and Maxwell. Dressing in white.
White, huh? The naval shirt, white pants, no cap, white cap. There wasn't any firearms given to us or anything. It was more lectures and that kind of stuff. But it was based on normal military co-ops.
Perfect. Fascinating.
Then Jørn and I call another name of the list, a man named Alexander Jones.
Yes, hello, Mr. Jones.
Yes.
And when we phone him, I simply ask him, did you ever hear anybody discuss Dag Hammarskjöld while you were active in Saimaa?
I see. Now it's starting to get, now I'm starting to get uncomfortable with the questioning.
And soon after, we meet with him. And he is the guy we have been looking for 6 years. So, simply put, what is Saimaa?
Saimaa was a clandestine mercenary organization for hire.
Financed by whom?
Financed by foreign governments.
And what was the purpose of Saimaa?
Saimaa was there to go and destabilize certain countries and basically we were soldiers.
Is it dangerous for you talking to us about this?
Definitely. Very. I mean, you know, I could get backlash from my own people. You sit in with a list of names and all of those names on that list are... can be verified.
But why are you taking that risk, may I ask?
I think it's about time that we need closure. I need personal closure.
But before I tell you about him, I should tell you about the case of Dagmar Fehl. I happened to discover a advert placed in a South African newspaper from Saimaa where they are looking for the killers of Dagmar Fehl. And we managed to find the brother of Dagmar Fehl, Carl Fehl.
My sister came to me and she said to me she needed to confide in me. She needed to sit with me. And,
sorry, I just...
No, of course. Yeah, okay.
I have a lot of guilt about it because she actually sat with me and said to me she thinks that they're going to kill her.
She told you that?
Yeah, and I said to her, who? And she said she doesn't know, but she thinks they're after her. And she said they'd already killed 3 or 4 people in the same team that she was part of. And I said, what team? And she said she couldn't tell me, but she knew that some of her comrades had been killed already. And I said to her, but what do you want me to do? And she said, I must just keep an eye on her, and if she gets into trouble, she'll let me know. And the other thing that she said is she needs to come to church with me. She needs to make right with God. She fully expects to be dead within the next couple of weeks.
His sister Dagmar was recruited into Saimaa. She had a background as a marine biologist.
So I believe you got your matric results. Yeah. I mean university.
University results, yeah.
How did it go?
Oh, it was very good.
What do you mean by good?
Well, I passed.
How well passed? She did mention, in no particular detail, that what she'd studied was particularly helpful in the work that she was doing then. In other words, the research element of what she did in marine biology was using on a daily basis in this particular role. But what I found very peculiar is that she had a regular office job in working as a secretary and an admin assistant in Johannesburg, but yet she was doing all this research behind the scenes. But she never, ever told me what it was.
Was it like working in a laboratory?
Yes.
In a laboratory?
Yes.
Clinical research?
Yes.
But where?
She never told me. The topic of AIDS research came up several times, quite loosely in conversation. I never put two and two together.
And she became a white supremacist. And she traveled to Mozambique and other African countries bordering with South Africa to bring vaccines to people there.
But she discovers that these vaccines from Saima are contaminated.
And because of that, she wants to leave Saima, and she wants to tell the police, the authorities, about what is going on. But before she managed to do so, she is murdered.
And I dashed across Johannesburg and got to her apartment, and I found her white VW Beetle parked in front of the security gates of her flat. I found her lying in the street.
Such a long time ago, and it's still a bit of a shock.
It's November 1990?
Yeah.
Did the police investigate this murder?
No. They had absolutely no interest in pursuing the case at all.
Why?
I can't tell you.
Then we go to see Alexander Jones. He was a member of Saima's Delta Unit. It was like their special forces division.
Saima was not a Mickey Mouse organization. We were not just a bunch of guys that got together on a weekend and decided to go do some military exercises and stuff like that. So this was a living, breathing body.
And what was your role specifically? Were you in the front line, so to speak?
Yes, I was definitely in the front line. Operational front line, hand-to-hand front line, fighting front line, leading operations, if you want to call it that.
Did you kill people yourself?
Yes.
For example, well, we can go. There's the barracks down this side.
How many people did it involve, Saima?
Anything from 5,000 people upwards.
That many?
That many. So Saima was a big organization. Look, Saima was very clever in the way that they operated. We may have known about the other units, but we didn't know who was in the other.
It was self-structured.
Self-structured units. They would have a holding body, if you want to call it, and then they'd have the substructures to it. But you and I could be sitting in the same room, and you could belong to the medical division of Saima, and I wouldn't know you from a bar of soap.
In front of us now would have been your main hall, which would have been your mess hall and your gathering place. This is where we would have had ceremonies in Fadia. There would be dinners, formal dinners, you know, it depends on celebrating different occasions in the history of Saima, that type of stuff.
But you have in fact a parallel military structure working on an underground level next to the South African Armed Forces.
Yes. And next to the South African Intelligence Service, next to the South African Police Service. Most definitely.
Look, Maxwell, they were very sucker to the 1800s British naval traditions and attire, especially the hierarchy. We wore normal whites.
Maxwell would come there in his old 18th century Commodore's uniform.
Will he?
Yeah.
Like a Lord Nelson?
That's right, yeah. That type of...
uniform? With a hat?
With a hat. Everything. With a sword. Everything.
This is a picture of...
Maxwell.
Yes.
Yes.
He was looking like that?
Yes.
That's exactly what Commodore Maxwell looked like.
Did he wear white all the time?
All the time. I never ever saw him wear anything but white.
Always white?
Always white. This is Maxwell, yeah. Very intelligent person. Very manipulative. He commanded respect. If you met him, you just couldn't help showing respect to the general.
He was charismatic?
Very. But also very dangerous.
Dangerous in what way?
If he didn't like you and if you posed a threat to him, he would take you out.
He would simply kill you?
Yeah.
Himself? Or
himself, yeah.
Basically, this is operational headquarters for Saimaa.
Hmm. And you were here like, what, 20, 30?
Yeah, we were here. You know, I can't tell you how many times I've been here.
Hmm.
And what kind of operations were you doing?
Well, it was clandestine operations. We were involved in coups, taking over countries for... other leaders. We were involved in Mozambique spreading the AIDS virus through medical conditions. We were involved in Angola with Dr. Jonas Savimbi for various operations. We gave military support.
So people were killed during these operations?
Oh, definitely.
We you mentioned...
Can we... I just do the question again and then you can pop in?
Yeah.
You mentioned actively spreading AIDS?
There was a unit in from Saimaa that one of the things was that we went into African countries.
And how was that done exactly?
Through inoculation.
Through vaccines?
Yeah, through vaccines. Pretending to inoculate people and that type of thing.
The idea being to... kill black people?
Yeah, to eradicate black people. You must understand the concept was that AIDS was a killer. It was incurable at that point in time, so it was led to believe that if you infected people, it was the quick, non-militaristic approach to eliminate black people.
And that is something you know for a fact, that AIDS was actively being spread to other countries?
Yes, to African countries. We were at war. Black people in South Africa were the enemy.
But so it was about white supremacy?
Definitely. Definitely trying to retain the white supremacy on the African continent.
And furthermore, he tells us that the purpose of Maxwell's clinics in and around Johannesburg was to infect black people with HIV.
He had the one in Tokoza, he had the one in Alex.
Yes.
If I'm not mistaken, there was on the West Rand. So, and these were research facilities for them to inject people with a solution to see that they prevented AIDS in it. In the meantime, they were injecting people with AIDS.
And he was only working on black people in these clinics?
Yes, yeah.
For almost nothing?
Yeah. But that's what I'm saying. So you know what? I mean, what easier way to get a big guinea pig that you live in the apartheid system? Black people have got no rights. They need medical treatment. There's a white philanthropist coming in and say, you know what? I'll open up these clinics and I will treat you. I will do this. And meantime, you're actually the wolf in sheep's clothing.
That's gruesome.
Thank you.
Did you visit these clinics yourself?
Yes, I went to the clinic in Alex where there was the research facility. And there was monitors, there was tubes, there was a proper lab. If you want to say it's scientist lab, you know, a proper freaky scientist lab, definitely.
Were there clinics also in other countries?
Well, look, I know, personally that I know of, our base of operations for this project was in Mozambique. That I can tell you.
Where Dagmar Fehl was working?
Yes.
He knew about Dagmar Fehl and what she did?
She was recruited to do medical research in Maxwell's labs in Alexander. And then obviously she progressed and she became part of the inner circle for the operations, and she went to Mozambique to fulfill her obligations. And when it came, word got out that she was going to testify.
She was going to inform the authorities about Simon.
Correct, yes.
And the spread of AIDS.
That's right. And I think it's well known in our circles that it was Simon themselves that took her out.
But why would Saima place that advert?
Why wouldn't they?
It's like a decoy.
Exactly.
Another possible spin is there was an interview published in South Africa with Maxwell and an ensign, a woman named Debbie.
She's the young lady.
Yes.
Yes.
And
where she was at school when he recruited her from school.
Yes. We have tried to track her down, but we can't find her.
I don't think she's...
You don't think she's alive anymore?
Yeah.
But could that be Dagmar Fehl?
No, it's not Dagmar.
It's two different ones.
Her name is Debbie Campbell.
And Debbie's...
In the article, yes.
But Debbie's blonde.
Would the South African government, the apartheid regime, would they have known that Saima was spreading AIDS inside South Africa and outside as well to kill off black people?
Highly likely. Highly likely. That's why I'm telling you that's why people were killed for it.
That's why Dagmar Fehl was killed, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why Dagmar was killed.
You're wasting the champagne! You're wasting the music,
Mom! You're wasting the champagne!
You're wasting the champagne!
And after the death of Dagmar, Dagmar's mother continues to investigate the case. She wants to find out who killed her daughter. She tried to give witness about the event to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
Okay.
They told her no, because it was too controversial.
Yeah.
The murders were never found. The case was not investigated.
And they would not listen to her. In fact, I think the second or third time that she went to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, they escorted her out.
She was asked to leave.
Yeah, they would not debate this issue at all. She said, her words to me were to the effect that just the mention of the South African Maritime Institute made people nervous. They would not listen at all.
Then she befriends a Saima lieutenant,
mm-hmm.
or a Saima officer. I believe maybe it's Maxwell, who feeds her information about Saima and her daughter.
Yes.
He approached my mom. I don't know whether it was out of guilt or whether just a prick of his conscience. He contacted my mother and gave her a whole lot of documents. I believe they met several times. And in there are letterheads of the South African Maritime Institute. So this was the first time that I had ever heard of that institute. She was given a telephone number, a Johannesburg telephone number, to phone.
Yes.
And I vaguely recall my mom saying, this gentleman said, if you phone this number, you'll find out what you need to know.
You want Julian over the Thompson?
Yes, please.
Hold on. I'll try and get him for you.
Thank you. She phones that number, and suddenly Julian Ogilvie Thompson is on the line.
Hello?
Back then, the CEO of the giant mining corporation, Anglo-American.
He allowed her to speak. He allowed her to state why she was phoning, how she got the number, and she wanted to know more about what had happened to her daughter. And he gave her a veiled threat on the telephone.
I mean, I have no recollection of any of these things.
No?
No.
Do you remember speaking to the mother of Dagmar Fahl? Maybe she called you?
No, I didn't.
Interesting.
Why should she call me?
He said that he knew about me. He knew about my brother, my stepbrother. He knew where both of us lived, and that if she ever phoned the number again, there would be serious consequences.
Ogilvy Chumson told her that?
Yes.
Look, I'm afraid I have no recollection of either somebody being murdered or being telephoned by his mother.
Not long after, we go to an address in Johannesburg, where the personal belongings of Dagmar's mother are stored. She's dead now, Dagmar's mother. And in her belongings, we find an address book. There we have him. Julian Oakley Thompson.
We have him there. Yes.
Anglo.
Uh-oh.
What, Jan?
I found an interesting name here.
What?
Maxwell. K. Maxwell.
You have Maxwell?
Yeah.
What?
Would they meet on a regular basis, or...?
Most of it was telephonic, and then at one stage, she was informed that he's going to Namibia. He's fleeing the country, he doesn't feel safe here, and he handed all of this documentation to her, and she never heard from him again.
Maxwell was fleeing to Namibia?
The country of Namibia came up frequently, yes.
René Gore?
No.
Here we have it. René Gore, René with two E's, Namibia.
That's René Gore.
And he was in Saimaa?
He was in Saimaa. He was destined to take over from Commodore Maxwell.
He was going to be the new flag commodore?
He was going to be the new flag commodore. Yes.
And in that book, Dagmar's mother has made a number of notes. It says police, and then something has been crossed out. Then there's part of a name ending E-N-I-E and then F-R-O-E-R. No, this is Grunewald.
Yes?
It says Tini Grunewald.
Wow.
It says Tini Grunewald ordered Dagmar's murder plus four others.
It's incredible. In a way, it would make sense. I mean, Tini Grunewald, he was a key person, top figure in the military intelligence.
No, I can't see this organization as really playing a significant part. If they did, I would have known about it.
He's lying. The whole of South Africa knew about Saimaa. Everybody in the military field knew about Saimaa. The government knew about Saimaa. That's why we were allowed to operate out of South African premises.
But Saimaa was very interlinked with the South African army or navy?
I would say with the South African military.
Yes. Were they taking orders from South African military or...?
No, I think our main orders came from the British government. That's my opinion.
The British government?
Yeah. Well, from our British handlers, controllers, whatever. To this day, I still believe that we were a subunit of some British
entity.
Would you think that's really true?
You know, 3 days ago, I met Alexander Jones. He seemed very credible. He doesn't offer any documentation, but he sure seems to be a person who is in the know.
Let's put it this way. For 4 years after I left Saimaa, they tried to recruit me back every single month.
Every month,
Maxwell would set up a meeting with me, send somebody, stuff like that. And eventually, it became to a point of where they were indicating of threatening my family. And Maxwell and I went to his offices one day in Alex, and I threatened him. I said to him straight, as much as you know people, you've got things. Remember, I've also got my own team. I said, you guys either back off or one of us are going to die. So it ended on bad terms in the sense of, because I mean, I had enough. I had a family. Once I started my family, I wasn't single anymore. It wasn't just me. And I had to take a responsibility in it. So you know what you do? My view of thinking is get rid of everything that can incriminate you or get...
So you destroyed everything pointing towards you and Saima having a past together?
Yes.
But is it bad for the story?
Is it bad for the story?
This story?
Yes.
Because it begins with Jørgen Bjørkdal and I trying to solve the mystery about who killed Dag Hammarskjöld.
Okay.
And then suddenly it's something entirely different.
But I was going to ask, is the mystery solved, or you just switched to something else now, or you don't mind about what it was supposed to be solved in the first place?
So, did the South African Maritime Research Institute kill Dag Hammarskjöld?
There was involvement.
What do you base this theory on?
There was photos that I can recall seeing in one of our meetings, and that is what they used as a recruitment tool. There was one photo where you could see where all the trees were burnt, where there was a forest. I assume it was a forest where all the trees were burnt in it. You could see the anthills, stuff like that. There was a photo of the guys in their fatigues standing on the anthills and that. And then there was the photo of the plane on one side. So we were given three photos.
What guys were on the photo?
Maxwell was in the photo. He was very young.
Keith Maxwell.
Yeah.
Yes.
He was definitely there, because that was the thing. And I can still remember the picture. He was still wearing shorts, long socks, and combat boots, with his camouflage hat. There was two other guys. One was in full military fatigues. And he had a beard.
Could the bearded guy be the agent codenamed Congo Red?
Yeah, I would say 80% probably that would have been Congo Red.
That would be Congo Red.
Yeah.
Did you already summarize the whole story?
No.
Not yet?
No.
Maybe I can get an idea when you summarize it.
We do manage to establish that Saima was very real. But still, you know, it borders on fiction. Some of it is real and some of it is very difficult to prove. Maxwell meets with a South African journalist named David Potgieter.
Yes.
And he gives him a lot of Saima documents, including a sort of memoir written by Maxwell called The Story of My Life. It's a fictionalized account of Maxwell's life. But the part he gave David Potgieter is not the full story. The last part of the story is to be found in the possession of Dagmar Fale's mother.
Okay, that I found very strange.
Did your mother get this at one time only?
Yes. Yes. I think just prior to this, Lieutenant Maxwell, or Commander Maxwell, however he referred to himself, I think at the point where he was ready to leave, he gave my mother everything he had in hand to aid her and help her to find the murderer. Because why else would he have done this?
Yeah, I want to be sure that this is actually Maxwell writing these memoirs. This is his handwriting, right?
Yeah, no, this is Maxwell's handwriting.
Would he have been doing the... Because some of the pages had been written on a typewriter, and some of them are in hand.
Yeah, he had one of those old typewriters, if you want to call it. Yes. So it's possible, yeah.
Would he have done the typing himself?
Yes, yeah. But stuff like that, he wouldn't... He would not.
Would not use a secretary?
He would not use a secretary. He wouldn't... he wouldn't even use his wife. If his... One thing I can say, if we were having talks about Simon and his wife came into the room wherever we were, whatever, he'd tell her to leave.
It seems quite bizarre. It almost looks like the rantings of a person who's losing his mind.
Why would he write a fictionalized account of his life?
You know, at the end of his life, he had lost it.
He had gone mad.
So only he would know.
In the part of the manuscript of Keith Maxwell's memoir that was given to Dagmar Fehl's mother, he provides the context for the Operation Celeste papers, which suggests that Maxwell knew about Operation Celeste, the plan to kill Dag Hammarskjöld, before the papers ended up in the hands of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in 1998.
Has everybody got a copy of this set of documents due for maritime search?
This part of the manuscript is handwritten. Maxwell writes about how the men of the Marine Institute have plans for Dag. In the manuscript, Commodore Wackman chairs a brainstorming session about ways to kill the General Secretary when he comes to the Congo. One of the officers suggests poisoning Dag Hammarskjöld with potassium cyanide, much to the displeasure of Wackman. The agent known as Congo Red is present at the meeting and is just about to open his mouth when Commodore Wackman says, "No, no, I don't want hours of discussion about possible methods. I want a workable plan with at least 3 alternatives on my desk within 7 days.
Option 1 was the bomb to disable the plane to bring it down. That would have been choice number 1, so that the plane crashes. Number 2, have the fighter jet around as a contingency in case the bomb didn't do the damage that it did in the plane, and shoot the plane down. Number 3, have the contingency shooting from the ground to bring the plane ground and clean up.
There is a picture of Dag Hammarskjöld, and in the picture of Dag Hammarskjöld, there is a playing card tucked in his shirt
collar.
Yes,
there's an ace.
Yes.
Yes, there's an ace.
The ace of spades.
The ace of spades, and that was well known in security circles that was the way that the CIA operated. That was a CIA card, and that's why I say the CIA was involved.
So that is a calling card from the CIA?
That's a calling card from the CIA.
Did you encounter the ace of spades being used later on in your own career in Saima?
In Saima, yes, once or twice. Up in the DRC itself.
And that was also because of CIA involvement?
Because of CIA involvement. And I would even go and... Can you switch off?
Next, Maxwell writes about how a Saima operative plants a bomb in the wheel bay of Dag Hammarskjöld's plane. Then follows an emergency meeting in Saima's situation room at 2 o'clock in the morning on the 18th of September 1961. An operative has phoned to say that the bomb did not explode at takeoff. Commodore Wackman says, "Gentlemen, it's 2:30. Go home and get some sleep. We'll work something out in the morning." So in Maxwell's memoir, we have a Commodore Wackman who seems to be the same person as Commodore Wagner, who signs off on the Operation Celeste papers.
But then we showed Grünewald these documents, and he was totally dismissive of them. He said you would never put something like that on paper. He said it's very unprofessional.
It's not professional. Not professional at all.
I disagree, because a lot of our stuff went on paper. I disagree.
So it would be normal for Saima to put things like this on paper?
To the relevant people, yes.
The purpose being?
for confirmation purposes, for to say that there's backing, you know, there's approval, that it's sanctioned.
So Saima had, in fact, its own bureaucracy?
Yes, definitely. Very, and they were very strict and particular about it. For example, let's go back a few steps. When we saw Commodore Wagner, etiquette is you were not allowed to approach him.
You met Wagner?
Not personally, but I remember him being at one of the meetings.
You saw him?
Yes.
What did he look like?
Yeah, he was an old, frail man at that point in time.
Because for us, it is totally impossible to find anything about him.
Look, I know he was a businessman. Definitely.
What kind of business?
If I remember it correctly, it was something to do in the medical field.
Then a knock on the door. A lieutenant enters, salutes the Commodore, and hands him a slip of paper. What is this? Oh my God, it worked, Wagman said, and waved the message at the others. She blew on approach to Indola at around midnight. It worked. By God, it worked. There were smiles all around. Congo Red had delivered.
Anybody that resisted any white form of manipulation on the African continent, Saima was prepared to go and quell those for a price, at a cost. And that was one thing that Doug Hammarskjöld was totally against. And he wanted every country for the people of the country. And obviously when you've got investments, when there's minerals, gold, diamonds, oil and all of that stuff, and we all know which countries think he was a threat.
We countered effectively efforts from all sides to make the Congo a happy hunting ground for national interests. To be a roadblock to such efforts is to make yourself the target of attacks from all those who find our plans thwarted.
He was killed because he was going to change the way that Africa dealt with the rest of the world financially. And he was a threat. And who's got the most to lose? Corporate business worldwide. People are greedy. People want what others have got, and they don't want to pay for it. That's why they come to Africa. Because Africa seemed to be easy in third world. And now Africa's starting to fight back. And I think it would have happened 30 years ago, 40 years ago, if Doug Hammarskjöld had his way. Africa would have been a completely different continent today if Doug Hammarskjöld was allowed to live and follow through on his mandate.
So,
yes.
The last narration is about Göran Björkdahl will continue his work. Last I heard of him, he had gone up the Congo River.
Last I heard of him, he had gone up the Congo River looking for Maxwell's secret jungle laboratory.
Albertina, Pelosia, Penaglota, Johnny Penatapoe. Albertina, Comboyalotia. Pena glata, jani pena tapoe. Soko basenga diere, na pesa diere mbango. Komi toke na mboka, komi ya betomba. Soko basenga diere, na pesa diere mbango. Komi toke na mboka, e komi ya betomba. Alpetina, komo ya rosia. Pena plata, jani pena taboe. Albertina, como ya lo tía hoy.